Hi, welcome to Smarten Up, an education in professional wrestling, season three. I'm one of your hosts, Drew Zalitis.
I'm your other host, Stephen Claypool. You just said hi and froze, and I had just taken a sip of my beer, and if you had held it for like a second longer, I was going to do a spit take.
Spit takes are amazing on podcasts.
Yeah. You hear...
You could have just done pssst, and no one would the sound effect of...
You hear that, and then you hear all of my recording equipment shorting out as Guinness seeps down into it.
That would take us one step closer to our professed goal of the morning DJ radio show sound.
Hey!
Yeah. So clearly we're back with all the sincerity you've been missing. I'm really looking forward to this season, this series, whatever you want to call it. Because, you know, it's the third year. Mm-hmm. You know, you're established now. We've gotten the basics. And so, I'm envisioning this. We're envisioning this as, you know, if you're at school, you're now in the 300 level classes. Mm-hmm. You're a junior or a senior. And now you're supposed to start applying the stuff you've learned to the sort of topics that interest you.
We have expectations of you now. You owe us a thesis in just like the end of one more short season. That's when we'll be expecting your final work.
Yeah. Season four will be the capstone season, mm-hmm. which I'm looking forward to.
You have to apply to get into season five.
It's fair. That's very true. It's a select group. I like that. So what have you been up to? It's been a long time.
Oh my goodness. It's how did I spend my summer vacation? I spent it working way more than I should have, and traveling when I could. I did have the experience of going to Disneyland for the first time, which was a fun experience with a 7-year-old and 5-year-old girl in tow, Cynthia's nieces. We all went down.
Oh, well, that's the perfect mm-hmm. way to do it. Mm-hmm. So you're not just adults there.
Yep,
that's really cool. I've always been very interested to do that.
It was a lot of fun, and now I am. I think one thing that I did not do a lot of over the summer is did not watch a lot of wrestling. I followed a lot of wrestling. I understood what was going on, but there were times when it was getting kind of weird.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate, and I've had similar feelings. And it is interesting to say watch versus follow, because mm-hmm. I agree in the sense of, like, I know what's going on, and I'll tune in every so often, but the actual act of watching it in some ways has... ...in the past. In some ways, this has been the most in the mainstream WWE and wrestling in general has been in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But not for the best reasons.
Correct.
And that's something we'll talk about a little bit today. It's kind of the elephant in the room that you kind of need to talk about. It's something that we'll put it this way: people who don't know much about me, but know I like watch wrestling or I talk about wrestling, came up and asked me about it.
Oh, wow!
What's this thing going on?
Explain.
John Oliver mentioned something about WWE does shows in Saudi Arabia since when? Oof. And and it's like, you know what? We're, as a wrestling fan, we're still kind of keeping up with it. So, it's definitely worth talking about a lot.
Well, we'll touch on kind of all of that as we get into it, because the topic for today, you mentioned the Saudi Arabia show, the Crown Jewel show, and there's plenty to talk about with that one in particular, but there has been a growing trend over the last, I'd say maybe 3 years, primarily in WWE, but in other parts of the wrestling world that maybe don't have as much media exposure of, shows that operate outside of the normal convention or rhythm of what a wrestling calendar is supposed to be. Super shows that are held internationally with very different card structures and very different objectives. House shows that have become almost like pay-per-view events in and of themselves, minus the actual remote viewing experience. And that is a phenomenon that is unique to wrestling and unique to the artificial constructed reality of what wrestling is. And I think there is a lot in there to dig into. And so I think the idea of the smarten up super show is I think what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. And I think there are, like most things, a couple of angles to go about it. I mean, one is the sort of industrial economic reasons for it. And then I think the other part you mentioned is the sort of narrative storytelling results of that sort of need. So again, as always, you have the sort of economic constraints coming in with the sort of creative goals in mind. So, you know, I've read about this, and I haven't looked at the numbers myself particularly, but from what I understand, sort of, you know, the summer has had two sort of ups and downs for WWE, or really just the last year. In the up category, arguably they're making more money from sort of broadcast or television or the WWE network, just sort of the distribution of their content than they've ever before.
It's a beast now from a revenue.
Right, between making the money directly from the network and the new deal they got with Fox to have SmackDown on Fox, returning to broadcast, making a lot more money when you're on broadcast television. You know, huge deals there, huge numbers. On the flip side, their house shows, these are, again, the shows that are not on television that they usually do on the weekend, unless there's a pay-per-view that weekend, where it's usually smaller markets that don't have as big of an arena, so it won't look as good on television, but you can still fill it, or you could get a few people and make some money at the gate. Apparently, that is going way down.
Yeah.
And often some of those are maybe even operating at a loss. And it does seem almost a little antiquated for this sort of international publicly traded company that sort of, you know, gets mainstream publicity and things like that, still runs these sort of smaller shows. But at the same time, there's something really nice in that. And if you've never been to a house show, they're wonderful, of these little kind of slices of smaller, more personal, almost less stakes, but that almost makes it more fun.
Yeah, it's a piece of Americana, and
yeah, like, and a sort of self-contained sort of entertainment. Like, it's fit, again, we'll talk about this with the narrative, like, it fits in with the story, but it also sort of doesn't. I wanted to kind of start with that sort of economic side, because that sets up some of the changes we're seeing now, where they, as you said, there's these weird shows that they're not just house shows, but they're special shows. So I feel it's part of a larger trend to rebrand, but also just sort of maybe not even rebranding, but just like help the audience understand, see the value in a house show in a different light, because that value seems to be slipping.
Well, let's to understand kind of where we are, let's understand where we've come from. So let's hop in the Wayback Machine, and I'll get to like drop that in. I've been waiting to drop that in for months now. We hop in the Wayback Machine, and let's go back to really wrestling before the era of cable, maybe might be the right time to bring it up. Because you had, obviously, we in our Wrestling and TV episode, which I believe is a season one episode, we talked at length about basically since television has been around, wrestling is on television has been around, but the bulk of promotions up until the 1980s or the bulk of wrestling was done at a regional level, and you would have regional shows that might air on local TV, but most of the wrestling that was actually happening was a live show market. It is something that you go see. You go down to the War Memorial Arena, and you see your local wrestling promotion. Mm-hmm. And over time, as television kind of asserted control over the medium, and then as now we enter into the modern era where it's internet distribution as well, and of course pay-per-view in there in between, the purpose of that show changed. Originally, the show was your show. It was your weekly wrestling show, and if you wanted to know what was happening in WCCW, you went to the arena and saw the show. As time went on, the main show became what was on television, and house shows started to occupy a different space, one where there was still good business in it, so you would put on the show because it's a live ticketed event and you can make money off of it. Two, because it gave you the opportunity to try things that maybe you wouldn't have had the opportunity to do on TV. And there's one example in particular that I want to dig into on that that's actually quite recent. And three, it gave you the chance to, on a rare occasion, surprise an audience. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, if you only expect surprises on pay-per-view and you get them on pay-per-view, they're not surprises. And there have been instances in recent years of house shows being used strategically to actually deliver a shocking moment that have been interesting.
Yeah, so the shift that I think that's a really key shift here to talk about, that relationship between the live televised show and the live house show that's only for that local audience. And it makes me think a lot about, or compare it to, the sort of relationship between a sort of album that an artist releases and then the tour that they go on, right? There's this relationship of sort of the two things promoting each other, and like which one is primary and which one isn't. Mm-hmm. So for example, for a long time, the tour, like the concert tour, I'm going to start there and then we'll get to wrestling, was to promote the album. Right? We have a new album, so you tour to sort of sell the album.
And you're happy to break even on the tour.
Right. The real goal is selling it there. Now, because of digital distribution, because artists don't make as much from selling albums anymore because of piracy and other forms of, monetization through streaming and all this, now the tour is often, now the album is almost the promotion for the tour. Mm-hmm. Especially for the big name acts. Obviously, this changes at the level you're at. If you're at a smaller level, touring kind of still serves that function of sort of getting people to buy the album. But when we're talking about your sort of arena shows, your Taylor Swift or Beyonce or whatever, really, you make the money on the tour. Mm-hmm. Yes, you make money on the album, but ultimately, it's about putting on these massive shows. And that's just this sort of weird relationship. So to bring it to wrestling, there was kind of that same shift where it goes back and forth, where early, almost the I would argue earlier, the television show promoted the live show.
Yeah.
In the sense that, okay, here are a bunch of stars, and then you go to the live show because you want to see the live stars in person. The same reason you go see an artist perform, that even though you could listen to the album.
And you're on television maybe once a week, but you're running live shows 5 or 6 days a week.
Right, right. So you're sort of, it's more like a residency, right? Yeah. You're taking up residency somewhere. And so, and there's a lot of sort of academic theories here about liveness and sort of like why, because when you think about it, it's like, why would you go pay $50 to go see this artist that you own the album of? What's the difference? And there's a sort of desire for authenticity of like, oh, I want to see them actually playing the thing I listen to, like just that connection more closely. And I think wrestling has that same feel for the audience, that it's like, okay, even though, I'm watching live television, it's like, well, it's edited and, it's sort of seeing it happen in front of you. But that's sort of slipped away. Now that And so it's, I guess it's kind of the reverse from the music industry. Now that wrestling can make so much money from broadcasts, from digital distribution, the house show's function as the sort of moneymaker sort of falls away. Mm-hmm. And so now you're in this place where, well, is it a promotional function? Because is it really doing much for us? So it's this, it's almost vestigial, or it feels like this like leftover part. Obviously, I think it serves purposes for the audiences in those places. Because mm-hmm. Again, as I mentioned, they're usually smaller locations mm-hmm. where they're probably not going to get a big Raw or pay-per-view. You know, these smaller venues. But what does the business get out of it? So
it's from a money-making perspective, it's just not there at this point. And the percentage of wrestling revenue, at least for a company like WWE or a company operating in kind of a similar scale or in similar strata, is just not there. But to your point, the audience size and the audience composition in a house show is going to be materially different in a lot of cases than the live mm-hmm. audience on a televised broadcast or a pay-per-view. There's a degree of intimacy that's there that you don't necessarily get on the larger shows. And it does function in some ways, like I said earlier, as a safe space where you can experiment and try things out. When you think about the role that plays within the context of the larger promotion, it becomes kind of strange. I mean, you take someone like AJ Styles. AJ Styles is not going to try a lot of things out on a house show at this point in his career. Partially because AJ Styles is in his current mode, pretty much what he's going to be. Not that he's hit a ceiling, but he's refined. The example that I was alluding to earlier of an instance where the performers were unrefined and they used house shows to come together was the New Day. So the New Day began forming on an episode of Raw, I think, where Xavier Woods came down to the ring and confronted Big E and Kofi Kingston and said, we have to do something or else we're going to get left behind. And then they all left together and they were not on TV together for about 8 months. They individually had matches, but they were not coming to the ring with each other. There was no concept of an alliance or anything like that. But together for that period, they were working house shows. And they were gradually refining the gimmick that they were going to push towards. Because the original word that you would hear about them, and what, thank God they didn't go in this direction, was they were going to be the next Nation of Domination. But on the house show circuit, they were able to work through that in a space where they wouldn't have to be in the spotlight. And so then when they came back to television together, they were not fully formed, but to a point where they could get to where they needed to be. And now, a few years later, are all enormous stars in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think what you bring up, so the house show functions in a couple of ways. One, as a sort of... as like a sort of focus group, right? It's like, okay, we have an opportunity to try out some ideas. Because again, WWE doesn't have an off season, as they love to tell us. They're putting on multiple shows every week, like massive amounts of content. Where do you have time to react to it? Like to sort of judge that? You know, you can do it week to week and be like, oh, maybe this isn't working. But right, for those long-term plays that you're sort of setting up, for the people who are new to the main roster or are trying a new gimmick out, they've been repackaged, right? Or they just got called up from NXT. You know, it's some of it is just getting practice being on the road, too. Like, it's sort of a different lifestyle. Sure. So I think that's part of why... And then the other end of it, not just the focus groups, but the other thing we've mentioned is sort of as a sort of dress rehearsal, right? So a lot of, you know, if a big pay-per-view match is coming up or if these two people are feuding, you know, often they're not going to be wrestling against each other, especially if it's a top, you know, top of the card feud where it's like, all right, we want to keep these people apart because the big money is in the pay-per-view match. You keep them apart on TV, but you can throw them together in a house show because you're not losing money on that. You're not giving away the match for free. The only people who are seeing it are the few thousand who came out to the show. So those people can work together, get used to being in the same ring together, work on their sort of cohesion, because WWE doesn't have practice time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the NFL where they have the whole week to prepare for that Sunday's match. And so I think that's why house shows have stuck around as long as they have,
mm-hmm.
because like financially, maybe it doesn't make sense, but it makes so much sense in these sort of other non-directly material ways
mm-hmm.
that they want to sort of salvage them. And I think that's where these sort of super shows or these attempts at sort of restructuring these shows make sense. Because in some ways, they almost do more for WWE in that sense mm-hmm. rather than sort of monetarily.
So maybe let's make that pivot then. So now we've introduced the concept of the house show. And over, I used 3 years as the mark because the event that I remember that started this cycle was the Beast in the East event, which I think was 2015, which was a, for all intents and purposes, a house show in Japan. I don't know if it was Tokyo, but it was in Japan that took on greater significance, largely because WWE wanted a way to promote that Brock Lesnar was going to be on the show. And that kicked off this cycle of an increasing number of branded, sometimes broadcast, but more significant house shows. And the using kind of, if we take that example of Lesnar as that first entry point, I would say that there's a couple, the thing that happened in that period that correlated with the decline of the traditional house show was really the rise of the WWE Network. Like that's the obvious linkage and the obvious kicker.
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of that is the simple idea that like the network was WWE's own competition, mm-hmm. right? Like, okay, suddenly I have, you know, I can watch whatever I want. I can go back and watch an old pay-per-view. I can watch my favorite things. You know, does that lower the desire for people to go to a house show? Mm-hmm. You know, I can stay in that night and get my wrestling fix. I don't know. That's pure speculation. Again, I think there are 100 other reasons why, you know, these shows went down. Part of it I need to know more about is just the sort of the live entertainment market. You know, how that works. You know, there is still a market there. I think I've mentioned before on this podcast that I was a chaperone at mm-hmm. Disney on Ice for Xavier University, where I teach. And I was just, and the whole time I was there, I was thinking about wrestling, obviously, because I had seen wrestling at this very venue. And I'm like, oh, wait, yeah, this is the same business. It's the touring live show. And so that kind of was just the sort of economics there. As I understand it, I think for a lot of these places, and it's similar-ish, again, the tickets, the gate is less important than everything else. So for Disney on Ice, they're not on TV, but it was the merchandise.
Yep.
It was that kind of stuff. That's where you're making it. And then for the venue, they're making their money on concessions mm-hmm. and probably a cut of the gate. Like, I don't know the percentages, right? Mm-hmm. So like who's in it? What's in it for who is the kind of question,
well,
right?
Part of that and might so, also, the other kind of social factor that might be involved there in the live show market in general is we've talked about house shows as you're playing smaller arenas in smaller cities, smaller towns. Like the trend of the population, at least in the U.S., has been gravitating towards larger cities. There might not be as many folks in those small towns anymore. Like there's
exactly, you know. There's less because these are kind of, I guess, lower tier mm-hmm. venues, right? So you've got the sort of like huge arenas that they use for the massive pay-per-views. And then you've got your, maybe they don't have a professional sports team, but a minor league team mm-hmm. sort of venues that can house your Raws and SmackDowns. But then you've got that lower level, which is, you know, it's not a high school gym. It's still an arena, but you're not going to get, to put it in the music terms again, you know, maybe you're getting, like an older act, right? Like a mm-hmm. legacy tour, or you're getting like a more niche sort of touring band. Like those are the people who are sort of packing that space.
And my parents live in one of those towns. They live in Charleston, West Virginia, and that is exactly the last description that you had. There is the Charleston Civic Center in town. It holds about 13,000 people if it's packed to capacity. And in the past, that would have made it prime house show market. And house shows do still come through, but they are not the business they once were, because there are of a 13,000 seat capacity, there are 40,000 people in Charleston, West Virginia.
And I think that's a really great point that you bring up. It's just the sort of just the larger market, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, this is true in a lot of industries, like it's all gravitating towards the biggest sort of venue or the biggest marketplace. And so, I think that certainly speaks to that. So, and so that, to bring us back to these sort of specials, in some way, I guess we could also ask, are these specials now the thing that sort of replacing the house show experience for the people who maybe don't get the house shows anymore or never did, and now you can get it through the network, right? And I mean, I think that's what they're trying out. Speaking to Beast of the East in the East specifically, that was very much clearly also just a sort of, those were the earliest days of the network. That was a huge promotion point for the network to essentially say that was the first thing that they had that was nowhere else.
Yes.
Because you could still conceivably get the pay-per-views somewhere else. You would be paying ridiculous fees, but they wanted to be like, we're only offering it here. And so that exclusivity, that gets us back to exclusivity, which is part of that sort of house show experience and maybe does build an intimacy. Is there a way that they can create a sort of intimate experience that anyone on the network can watch? And is the way to do that these sort of weird house shows that they like promote, but they don't promote a lot? Like, and again, to our point about narrative, that they're part of it, but also not really. To kind of create the feelings one might get in a house show, but doing it in a way that they could still broadcast to millions of people on the network.
And part of it is, part of it extends to production as well. So the Beast from the East, I remember being, for all intents and purposes, a very stripped down show. It was not lit the way a WWE show is
and to be honest, a lot of international shows are like that, especially international shows, unless they're going to be doing a Raw SmackDown from there. Then they fly out all the equipment, like when they do it from England. But you're not getting at these smaller venues that they tour internationally.
Yeah. No, and so you had a very different feel there. And then as time goes on and you're moving into, you know, enormous super shows in Saudi Arabia and was it in Sydney,
Melbourne.
Australia? Melbourne.
Melbourne.
You are not just increasing the size of the audience, you are increasing the production value as well and getting more towards a point where you're saying like these are shows on the same level, which is a really different space to be in.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is I wonder how much they knew about this when, I remember, I think it was a year or two ago, they were like, all right, we're going to cut back on our pay-per-views, right? I think this was only about a year ago, because you had the brand split, and they had, for a while, you know, they re-split the brands, mostly because they just had a massive talent pool, and I feel like they were like, we're not using any of these people. They still aren't, and they have two shows. And again, the brand split was also a house show strategy, because then you could run two house shows in two separate locations on the same night, which they usually do. Also, SmackDown runs a house show Monday night. Not always, but often, which is crazy because you're competing with yourself. Like, you want them staying home to watch Raw, don't you?
There is invariably, when they come to the Bay Area, there is invariably the same night that there will be a show in Oakland or San Jose, there will be a house show in either the other city or in Sacramento.
Right. At a smaller venue. Right. So anyway, so that idea of, so they go back to this brand split and For a while, they had separate pay-per-views too, and then they just cut that out. And at first, I just read that as they realized it's not worth it. They did it early on because the network was still young, and they wanted people thinking, "I'm getting like three or so specials a month. Like that's amazing." And we talked about this on this show, how much that was possibly diluting the idea of your special events. Like if you have two special events, if you have a special event every other week, it's not very special.
But they're
And they
still
sort of
having special events every other week. They're just having
fair
them
enough, at least in the last few weeks. But
differentiated
right.
in a way.
Right. And so that's precisely the point, right? That it's sort of coming into a new way. So now I question, because they knew they were setting up these deals for these special shows in other countries and maybe even in this country, was that part of the reason to cut back on the dual branded pay-per-views? Because that was
Maybe.
only this
It was this
year. I think it was
year or
after
yeah.
WrestleMania because it was like Backlash. Now all the pay-per-views are co-branded. And so the timing seems to align with like, okay, they almost knew we were going to have these more special super shows. And so it wasn't viable anymore. So it's a completely new business model. This was a big part of the mainstream coverage of the Saudi Arabia shows, is like the massive amounts of money that WWE gets for these shows, both Saudi Arabia, but even Australia, which has none of the political baggage as the Saudi Arabia show was a part. It was paid for by Australian Tourism Board. Like, they are full-on ads for come visit Australia. It's the same thing with Saudi Arabia, but again, loaded with political issues. And so putting all that to the side, which is a big put, this is WWE can now make money on what are essentially house shows. But if they want to promote these house shows to everyone else, which they have to do, because otherwise, why would Australia pay you the money for this campaign? You have to put it on TV and you have to make it part of your storyline. And then suddenly, this isn't a house
And
show.
that, yeah, that's where it gets weird. And so you see that weirdness coming through in ways that comparable shows wouldn't have. And so let's take a step back for a minute. When you proposed this topic a few weeks ago, I started thinking about, okay, we were specifically focusing on the international space. What is a comparable international historical event in WWE? And the one that you go to is SummerSlam 92, where the British Bulldog beats Bret Hart at Wembley Stadium. Big deal, but it's SummerSlam. It is the non-WrestleMania event. It's the WrestleMania of the summer. So that's a big deal. And then you would have a variety of local, not local, but pay-per-views that were international over the course of the years, like Insurrection, I think
Insurrection.
was the one of
Yeah,
the
I
Attitude
remember
Era.
that. Yeah. And like, and we're kind of just a point of order, we're kind of discounting Canada in this, Toronto and stuff. They get
North
shows.
America
It's
is, yeah.
international, but yeah, it's you're not flying. Like, in terms of production, it's not a big difference. But just to clarify, yeah.
But you had that history of events, and but those were very much of a time, of a place, and not radically disconnected from what else was happening. But the space that you're in now is you have these super shows that you're running in different parts of the world. You need to sell it to your audience. You need to fill a stadium. And you are, because you have to now put it on TV to sell it, it becomes part of your continuity. And continuity is something I really want to talk about here, because wrestling is a fictional form. It is, if you think about as a storytelling construct of long-term continuity with recurring characters, the closest comp is comic books. And if we're thinking about comic books as the comp there, there are at various points in comic book history moments where the structured history of the world that the stories are taking place in gets reset. Superboy punches the walls of reality, and different things happen or things change. Yeah, Flashpoint, so you have these ideas of continuity. And wrestling operates on that principle, but in a really weird and conflicted way. Events that happen at house shows do not usually affect what is happening in the story on television. There are rare instances where they do. There's a title change at a house show. So, you know, someone gets hurt, and now there's something that needs to explain that. But generally speaking, continuity is unaffected by that.
Well, again, we're talking like televised continuity, right?
Televised
like
continuity.
Those examples are like they become real when they tell us it's real. Like when they tell us, because you could call your friend who went to the show, and they could be like, "Oh my gosh, this guy, you know, this character did this thing that was totally out of character." And then if they show up on TV the next day and they're right back into the character, that's not continuity. Like, it's continuity for the people who were there, but not everyone else. So it becomes this sort of, it's almost like an outtake or a blooper. Like, it's, you know, it's part of it, but also not.
So now you're in a position where you have to promote shows that you would not have promoted before. And we'll take the example of the Super Show in Melbourne. So the main event of the show, or one of the main events, was Triple H versus The Undertaker, which is purely a nostalgia act. And was explicitly billed as a nostalgia act. And if this was a house show that wasn't being broadcast, and that was what you were putting on the card, no one blinks at that. It's like, oh, it's an opportunity to see these legends.
Yeah.
But because you have to televise the show, and because you have to promote the show, now these guys are appearing on Raw every week. And the purpose of their characters on Raw, which had not been established prior to this, is to promote this one match that does flow from a history, but does not flow organically from any story that's being told contemporaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a really weird place to be in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why in the build to these shows, especially with those matches like the one you mentioned, where like the matches only exist on the super shows, right? Mm-hmm. So Triple H fights The Undertaker, and that leads to a match at Crown Jewel. It doesn't lead to a match at another pay-per-view. So it's like this, like it's on its own track. Like the trains are running parallel, but they're making different stops.
Mm-hmm.
You get this build, which is almost overtly selling the show. Like, it's like in the way that only Paul Heyman was able to do it, where Paul Heyman would sort of be like, I want you to log on and buy the network
because
you want to see Brock Lesnar kick so-and-so's ass. Mm-hmm. Like, he could do it because it fit with his character. Like, it doesn't make sense when The Undertaker is like selling a pay-per-view, but that's what they're doing. But he was always doing it, but now it's more overt. So, I mean, part of that's just crappy.
It's the difference between selling a show and selling a story.
Yeah, exactly.
And selling wrestling shows, that's what wrestling is. But you do it in the guise of a story. You do you tune in to see a specific thing that is an extension of what you've seen before, and just the way that it was framed. There was no build up to the idea of Triple H and The Undertaker fighting in Melbourne. There was an announcement, and then Triple H showed up on Raw to talk about the announcement.
It was justifying it after the fact.
Yes.
Like, it put the cart before the horse. It wasn't like, we hate each other, now let's have a match. It was, we have a match, now let's find out why we hate each other.
Yeah.
Which is just bad. I mean, I'm trying to think of a more interesting way to put it, but that's kind of what it is,
yeah,
right?
Because then you have both of these guys showing up on Raw every week. They are getting into physical altercations for no reason other than that a match was announced with them in it.
And to be clear, like, that happens in other stories. Like, I want to point that, like, even like, so just to take another recent example, like Daniel Bryan wins a number one contenders match, so we know he is next, he will fight AJ Styles.
Yep.
So that's putting the match before the story, But it's still within a larger continuity, and they, you know, we had to, and then so they do something similar where it's like now establishing why Daniel Bryan is going to fight. But there was still a larger story there. It fit into the character of Daniel Bryan coming back from injury. He wants to be to the top. Like, so it's not just that they set a match and then they tried to find out why they set the match. They set the match between people who aren't on television and thus have no story. Like, every time they go away, that's presumably another conclusion to their story. No one was like, oh, I can't wait. Like, I wonder when The Undertaker will be back. You just don't. It's out of sight, out of mind. Why think about it?
The specific appeal, and this is something that I think is much more obvious in the Saudi Arabia cases, but the specific appeal of the nostalgia act in these spaces as what is being leaned on to sell. With again, putting a lot to the side, and it's a lot to put aside, Hulk Hogan was at the Crown Jewel event in Saudi Arabia. No justifiable reason why, but he was there because that was what the specific request that was made was. And so you're leaning into this nostalgia period, and large checks are being written to these nostalgia acts to get them into that space, done divorced from the continuity of the world around them. And one of the things that I'll be interested to see, if this model continues to evolve, and I think WWE's agreement with Saudi Arabia is, well, it's something absurd, like a 10-year deal or something.
Yeah,
like
that. I have no idea how ironclad that is. But,
yep. I fully expect to see, given that the Australia show was apparently successful, I'd expect to see other types of these shows happening.
There could be at least four a year. Yeah. And that's, when you think about the promotion cycle, you're going to always be promoting one of these super shows. Like, this is right now a sort of lull, and like, maybe we won't have one until WrestleMania, but there might be, I don't know. Even WrestleMania build ran into the Greatest Royal Rumble build. So yeah, this could be a constant presence.
And it's not going to be like you send the B team out to do the super shows. You got to send
literal
your star.
B team.
Yeah, exactly. It's Bo and Axel. Those are the
you
two guys
they're
that
not
going to
sell.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, that'd be great. Bo versus Axel, 3-hour Iron Man match.
I'm down.
But you have to put your best foot forward in these environments. And right now, the way that Vince McMahon has interpreted that is, I need to put the biggest stars that someone may have heard of on that card. The Undertaker's not going to wrestle six times a year at this point. Triple H is not going to wrestle six times a year at this point. Your nostalgia acts wear out. And as that happens, is there a greater need to incorporate what is happening in these shows into your normal wrestling rhythm? Or can they actually stand apart as almost a separate continuity?
Yeah, I mean, I think they want to tie it in more. I mean, if we're only looking at the three that we have now between Greatest Royal Rumble, the Australia show, and Crown Jewel, you know, the first one, Greatest Royal Rumble, had almost no consequence. The only thing of consequence was the tag team champions were crowned, and that's because there were no tag team champions on Raw. So that's the only thing that got established. And I mean, honestly, a lot of those matches were literally either repeats of WrestleMania or they were repeated at the next pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So it seemed inessential, and it seemed that WWE was trying to correct that. So maybe the original plan was these should be relatively inconsequential, like a house show. But then, you know, they had a fair amount happen in Australia. Like, you had, as I mentioned, a number one contenders match, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, clearly that's going to have an establishment. You know, I'll put it this way. I think for now, they're at least with Saudi Arabia, they're going to try to make those as inconsequential as possible.
Oh, yeah.
Because, and you saw this after Crown Jewel, they did very little recapping because they know that it's sort of toxic now. So in a weird way, it's almost like these might become more less consequential out of the political backlash than any other narrative storytelling reason. But it might be good for them. I'm not saying it's a good thing for them to be doing these shows, but from a storytelling perspective, it might work out. Because obviously that's something that they were kind of forced into doing. We don't know how consequential Crown Jewel would have been, given, you know, the sort of bad mainstream publicity that they got. It might have still not been that big, but we really don't know. And that's going to be a tough balance. It kind of, to me, would depend on, again, where the financials come from.
Yeah.
Does it really, are these specials a really a selling point on the network? And is it a priority to make them so?
So let's think about the economics of this across three different lines here. You have the boost to the network. Okay, yeah, this is exclusive content. Can you in some way attribute marginal viewership or marginal engagement X to that? And that's probably the area where it's going to be least consequential, honestly.
Exactly, yeah.
There's area two, which is the, not necessarily the gate, but the financing that they are getting from local governments, and which is material. I'm actually interested to see the financials from this quarter and see what that actually appeared as. And then the third would be overall brand value, and this is the knife that cuts both ways, because to your point, you've got obviously the political backlash at the Saudi Arabia show, but if you set that aside and you think about model shows in Australia, in potentially India, where there was a show maybe a year ago, Japan, you know that they've got their eyes on China in whatever ways they can. Can that build the brand? And that becomes more important at a point in time where you are getting ready to go back on network television. You are getting ready to have to present a face to a different kind of audience and a different television audience than you have in quite a while. So does this impact you in that front, and does that ultimately become beneficial? I don't know. The short-term money from the local governments is something that definitely does pay off. But in terms of long-term impact on the business, I don't know. And particularly when you are leaning so heavily on nostalgia acts here, at what point do these just become international pay-per-views?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. I think the short-term versus long-term benefits is the right sort of perspective to look at this. Because, it's definitely playing the short game. Yeah. It's like, here's a giant stack of money. Come. And it's like, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out later.
Say what you will about Vince McMahon. He's not a man to run away from a giant stack of money.
Right. And, you know, not to say that that's totally foolish. Like, I don't know what they're doing with that money. Maybe they're reinvesting it in something else. Or maybe he's just throwing it all at XFL. I don't know.
But, oh, God. I forgot about the XFL. I haven't thought about that.
We all did. But don't tell him that. But, you know, it's an influx of cash. But that's not a great way to run a business. That's when you're a startup. And they're not a startup. So the only reason you do that is if you have a specific goal in mind for your expansion. I don't know what that is. They might have one. We don't know. I mean, I thought they already did their sort of at least push of the network in other countries. But maybe this is part of that too, right? You know, maybe they need more international numbers on the network. And this is a way that's a sort of low risk way to try to raise those numbers, because at least you're getting some money from it, right? You're not the one who's putting a lot out to go tour internationally if they're going to pay you a lot to come visit. So, you know, that might be part of that long-term game. To give them credit, I do think there is value in playing that international field more. That's something WWE has on almost anything else. When it comes to doing live shows internationally, like that's it. I mean, look at the NFL. They're trying to grow internationally by having a couple of matches in either Mexico or UK, and it's not working great because they've reached a critical mass. And I don't know if WWE has reached a critical mass in the US, but you know, I think that's just sort of part of it. It's something that they can do that those other sort of places can't. And and they're going to sort of milk that. No one's paying the NFL to come have a match. The NFL is like, please let us come have a match here.
And you're,
like,
you're seeing this from,
doesn't have that problem.
You're seeing this from every major American sports league right now. Every year there's a couple of games that are happening in different places. But there's, I think, a couple of things here that differentiate WWE in that space. And Vince, like, let's say up front, Vince McMahon, for whatever you criticize him for, and there's a lot to, Vince McMahon is a pretty smart businessman. Like, the idea of Vince taking a one-time payday when he has the opportunity to get more than a one-time payday is a little unbelievable. So if you think about, there is potentially a goal in place here. Wrestling as a medium, and we've discussed this before, is it is something that has international appeal in different forms. Wrestling in Japan is different than wrestling in Mexico, is different than wrestling in the UK, and so on and so forth. But the basic idea translates in a way that American football doesn't. Just the reality of where you're coming from. It would be stunning to me if, in the scope of these super shows that are being constructed, if we don't see a full-blown super show in Japan in the next 2 years, particularly given some of the news about the state of New Japan Pro Wrestling right now. There might be blood in the water there.
And the massive influx of Japanese talent that WWE, it almost seemed weird at first. And I thought that they were backing off of it after both Asuka and Shinsuke Nakamura won the Royal Rumble, and then both of them failed. Their championship matches and have been sort of relegated to the mid card now.
It still makes no sense to me.
It does. But, you know, putting that to the side, I wondered, does that mean you're sort of giving up on the Japan thing? But then they go and sign, you know, massive Japanese talents. Yep. One didn't sign, but I'll hint at to come in my recommendations at the end. So I think we're getting to maybe a topic we'll talk about later. So it might be a good place to sort of wrap up there. But because does this fit into a larger strategy of international expansion? But there are multiple strategies to that. And you sort of have, and we're assigning people here, but we don't know the behind the scenes. Triple H is establishing his sort of like NXT UK and like things like that, and bringing in these sort of international talents. And I've talked about this before, I think that's the winning strategy. More so because, and that's in some ways kind of like the exact opposite of this nostalgia act. Instead, you're just saying, hey, here are local talents you already have. We're just giving you the WWE sort of blanket. And it's closer to something I've mentioned on this show before, which is the franchise model. Where
the Shane Douglas model.
Yeah. Like, all essentially what you've done is like they basically in the UK took Progress Wrestling, which is a UK brand, and then they just basically said, okay, this is ours now. And that's smart. And so I think we're gonna see both of those strategies going on right now, because WWE is, if anything, sort of schizophrenic with some of its planning. But we'll see which one sort of bears fruit in the end. Do they use But that gets to the other part of just the weird, like, disconnect between, like, NXT as just, like, Triple H's thing and Vince doesn't care. Because it's like, how is that not your next step of doing a huge super show in the UK and you've already got this sort of talent there and you just mix in some of your mainstream stars? Yep. Like, where's that synergy? It's bizarre. Like, it seems like completely different strategies. But, again, I think that's stuff we can get to later. I think we've touched on things that we can come back to, whether it's these general international strategies, whether it's WWE's getting into some nasty political spaces, just some other stuff. There's so much current stuff that we haven't even gotten into. Just in terms of like the relationship of these shows to how it fits with when you talked about their overall branding, like they're also at the same time promoting the first all women's pay-per-view as part of this big branding initiative, right? And it's like, what is going on? And talk about schizophrenic, right? So, like, literally within a week of each other, your head sort of spins. And what makes WWE different than a lot of other companies that might have some of these sort of seemingly conflicting identities is that those identities meet on the same show, on the same week. You watch Raw and you get both of that. And that's the difference. It's not like, oh, it's not like a TV, like, oh, that network airs this really progressive show, but also this regressive show or something like that. It's in the same space.
Same show.
And it's so sort of upfront about it. But it, in some ways, WWE can use a whole lot of strategies that we've already talked about to sort of mitigate a lot of that inherent stress that comes from that, or tension.
Yeah, wrestling's weird.
Yeah, it sure is, man. Whew. Yeah, it's been weird. Like, I feel like some folks will be like, oh, maybe they were just not recording because it's just been like, what's happening? And even just like, it doesn't, like, well, it was weird just being in the thick of it, and just, you had regular pay-per-views, you had this Evolution pay-per-view, and you had these two super shows all within about like a 2 month span, and it just showed in the product as being really just sort of at a wit's end. And just like, wow, as soon as you break from the regularity, things go off the rails really quickly. But it could, they could bounce back. It could become a new standard. Maybe this is just growing pains. Who knows?
Yeah, it is about standard. It's about what's the wrestling has evolved for like the last 20 years into a particular rhythm. And this is breaking that rhythm. You don't know if it's good or bad, but it is a break.
Right. It's not a subtle thing where it's like, oh, now we have an extra pay-per-view, or now we have two shows a week instead of one. Like, this is a fundamental, like, one of the biggest sort of shifts in that rhythm we've maybe seen in quite some time. Yeah.
Cool. So let's close out that topic and move on to our homework assignments.
Yeah. So I'll, just because I already sort of hinted at it, I'll throw it out again. So, if you're looking for one bright spot from the last few months in WWE or in wrestling in general, to be perfectly honest, I've got to point to the Mae Young Classic second edition. Fantastic stuff. You know, we've talked about this before. It's maybe something we can talk about at another point. Like, the awesomeness of tournaments.
Yes.
Just in terms of, like, if you don't know wrestling, it's a complete, it's one of those rare complete stories in wrestling. To compare it to the comics again, it's like a special event where it's like, okay, if I just read this, I've got everything I need. It's like a graphic novel. Like, I don't need to know everything else. Like, you go in there, and especially in the Mae Young Classic, where the vast majority of the talent are not signed to WWE. They are on these sort of short-term contracts that are just for the tournament. They are not ongoing characters. You have a few, but you also mostly have these sort of special appearances. And it makes the storytelling fun because it emphasizes the in-ring work. It's contained, and you just get these sort of special moments. So I'm just going to specifically call out just whoever brought in Mako Satomura.
She was the breakout star.
If you are not, I mean, you say breakout star, and she's 38 years old. Like, she's been doing this for like 30 or 25 years, I think. Like, she, you know, is this sort of legend in Joshi Japanese women's wrestling. And it was just fascinating to see her kind of in a WWE space. And in some ways you think, because she's not sort of, she's not even your Kairi Sane's or, you know, people who are signed to WWE and are thus being groomed for the sort of mainstream audience. She just comes in for this.
Yep.
And you could very easily see that as being, okay, she's going to stand out in a weird way because she doesn't do it. And no. She owned that space. Mm-hmm. And so watch any of her matches. Her semifinals against Toni Storm is terrific. Mm-hmm. probably the Mercedes Martinez match is probably the best match or one of the best matches I've seen all year. Mercedes Martinez versus Mako Satomura was just awesome stuff, and awesome just from a purely in-ring perspective, but also just from, like, again, the thing that I hope for in WWE, and I get excited when I see, again, this sort of model of, hey, we're a place you can see different things. You can see this Japanese wrestler who, you know, has been around forever, but you've never heard of her, and we're going to be the gateway for you. Mm-hmm. Like, that's great. And, you know, be a place where we can discover again, because you don't get to discover on WWE, because they are like, this is the new person, like, they're telling you. So there's this weird sense of like, man, like, you hooked me up to this cool wrestling, and it gives WWE a sort of almost like a different level of credibility that I think is something that they're sorely lacking in other places. And I don't know how else to call it, but it's sort of a credibility in talent and in an eye for wrestling. So anyway, that's a long way to say, just watch Mako Satomura. Even if you don't want to watch her in the Mae Young Classic, she's freaking awesome. You know, definitely. And she I also like is because she is not a bastardization of strong style that has now, I used quote air quotes there, that that WWE uses to basically describe any, like,
Japanese wrestler.
Japanese wrestler, and I'm like, no, but she is legit strong style, which is just like mostly strikes, mostly submissions. Like, there's very little grapple moves, but she does bust some out every so often. But yeah, she's my new wrestling crush, Mako Satomura. Oh, love it.
Well, I love the point you made about specifically the tournament format there, and you think about the role that she plays in that, because you have the opportunity within this discrete framework to introduce this character, establish her through her actions over the course of several matches, and ultimately I think she lost to Toni Storm in the semifinal. And because of that buildup, Storm comes out of that looking significantly stronger and significantly better going into the final that she ultimately wins. But she does not hit that if she doesn't have to go through this character that's been built up through the path that you've described. So it is good traditional wrestling storytelling in a discrete context, using a talent that is, because to your point, she's unsigned, ideally suited for that kind of role.
Exactly. Like, you know, in some ways, yeah, use that to your advantage. You don't have to deal with the sort of, you know, the fears of your main roster talent of like, oh, but if this person loses, then they lose credibility, and then we have to build them back up. Like, use it. And like, but at the same time, that doesn't mean you can have her come in and lose in the first round, because that doesn't work within the storytelling. Because, like, you can't just tell us. It's the show, not tell. You have to show us that she is a dominant legend. Mm-hmm. And she did that in her first three matches. And so then, exactly, it made that semifinal match all the better. Like, just great work all around.
So my homework for you is also has an international flavor, but is about as far from this as we can get. It is actually next up on my list of games to play on, because it has recently hit the Nintendo Switch. There is a very highly regarded game in the Metroidvania genre called Guacamelee, which is you play as a agave farmer in Mexico who is gifted with an enchanted lucha mask, and then becomes a wrestling marauder through his interconnected world. And if you're a fan of Metroidvania games, which tend to be games that have a connected world where there is continuity and environmental effects, where you are going through looping paths, you are encountering obstacles that you may not be able to solve for hours later until you have built up kind of your skill set, your understanding of the game's world, and your capabilities. Guacamelee has a wonderful reputation within that space. So the first game just hit the Nintendo Switch. The second game, I think, did as well, or will soon. And both of those are things that are going to be on my my Thanksgiving and then kind of post-Thanksgiving work travel Switch queues. So
those are great choices. Yeah, I've played both of them. I love those games. And yeah, the just even if you're not, I don't know. I was going to say, even if you're not a fan of wrestling, but I'm like,
what are you doing here?
But they are just very good games, like gameplay wise and stuff, outside the structures of the sort of, you know, lucha culture and things like that. So, yeah, excellent choice. And definitely something anyone should check out.
All right, then I think we have come to the end of lesson one here in season three. So we are back. We will get back on a regular recording schedule and get these out to you as we have in seasons one and two. As Drew said at the top, we're going to use this season to go a little deeper on some topics and dig into some areas that maybe in a 101 class might not have been you might not have been ready for, listener, but you're ready now.
Yeah, Drew, for sure.
Where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at drzolides. That's drzolides. I think most recently I was at a digital media studies conference, so there's probably a lot of those tweets, but every so often I come back to wrestling. It's either one or the other. So that's where you can find me online.
You can find me also on Twitter at Stefan Claypool. That's at StefanClaypool. And yeah, if you have enjoyed what you've heard, please recommend it to your friends, but recommend that they start in our 101 level course. If they step in now, they're going to be lost.
And they're still good. These are evergreen.
Yeah, yeah. So
evergreen. This is not like, oh, we're only talking about what happened last week. Like, yeah. No. It's meant to be gone from the beginning. It's like cereal, really. you know, if you had someone come in now, they wouldn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. You know, just tell them it's like cereal.
Yeah,
and they'll listen.
It's us.
Why don't you just write that? Just
yeah,
write,
that's the good review.
It's
good
as
review.
Good as cereal.
Exactly not... like cereal.
Now I just want to do a sort of like parody episode where it's just like, so I went to the arena and just like just talking in that. I went to the arena, brought to you by MailChimp.
Yeah, yeah. This episode.
By the way, this podcast is not brought to you by MailChimp. I want to make this very clear. We are not given any money from MailChimp.
We can't be bought. We're not in Big Chimp's pocket.
I like that. I love it. Yes. Good. Well, we will be in your pocket when you subscribe to us and on your phone. And we will be in your pocket next week.
Or whenever the next episode comes out.
Still be, I can't even do the finish now.
All right.
Good
rest
night.
Called the match. Good night.
We're done.